Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown,
where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
Tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer. Welcome to episode 167 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom.
And Sarah Lytle, along with the rest of the crew. Our musical guest this month is Sammy Riggs from Dry Ridge, Kentucky. She is the winner of the latest Amplify Nashville Songwriter Showdown. We'll listen to her interview and three songs from her EP released in August. John Case serves as Executive Director of Traditional Arts Indiana and is a professor of folklore and ethnomusicology at Indiana University Bloomington. We'll listen to his interview with Pam Rader.
We have a Valentine's story from Deb Bowden. Rick Albertson shares a harrowing Brown County adventure. Jim Eagleman and Dave Seastrom share their essays. And Sarah Lytle interviews Mike Kelly about the story of Stonehead.
Our first segment begins with the Amplify Nashville winner, Sammy Riggs, and Pam Rader shares her interview with folklorist John Kay.
This is Chuck Wills with the Brown County Hour, and our musical guest this month is singer-songwriter Sammy Riggs, who is the winner of the most recent Amplify Nashville songwriter competition at the Brown County Playhouse. Welcome to the show, Sammy.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We heard you at the Playhouse competition, and of course, you walked away with the first prize. Tell us about that experience.
It was really amazing. It was not what I expected at all. Last year in general, I kind of told myself that I needed to say yes to things that maybe I had just not tried, or I've never really loved competition stuff. You know, as a musician through the years, I've done some things and I may have been scorned in some ways of not winning things over time, you know, especially when you're younger, you get your feelings hurt more. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to go. And I thought I was just going to go that night and I was going to play a couple songs and I wasn't going to move on because I wasn't from the area, because I knew it was an audience vote for whoever moved on. But here I was with my pessimism, just thinking I wasn't going to go anywhere with it. And then I moved on and wound up winning it.
Yeah. And you said you're not from the area. You actually live down in Kentucky, don't you?
Yes. I am in Dry Ridge, Kentucky. So I am about 2 hours and 15 minutes away from Nashville, Indiana.
So how did you find out about this competition then?
I feel somewhere I saw an advertisement on Facebook for it. And in one of the pictures, I noticed a duo that's from around here called Stick and Bindle.
Oh, yeah. We know them.
And I was like, okay, Stick and Bindle's really good. If they're doing it, I should do it.
You certainly did come and make an impression because you walked away with first prize against what was clearly pretty stiff competition.
Yes, most definitely.
Do you think of yourself first as a songwriter or first as a performer? How does that fit for you?
I guess it's a little bit of both, especially now that I'm playing my original music more. I mean, I have to have songs that I've written to be able to perform them. But the performance aspect, sometimes I feel like I struggle there because of maybe the topics that I write about in songs. And so I do write about deeply personal things, and sometimes those topics are emotional. And that's something that I feel like I'm working on all the time, just trying to perform them to the best of my ability. And I think that's definitely something that I am focusing on this year and just trying to make that as best as I can, you know, just performing as well as possible.
Sure. Well, I know as an artist, sometimes it can be really challenging to offer that level of vulnerability in front of an audience.
Yeah, and it's weird because I've been writing for a long time, but I think for a while I almost strayed away from writing about certain topics. And then I think this just happens as you get older. You're kind of like, screw it. I'm just going to sing about whatever I want. I'm not going to worry about hurting someone's feelings, you know. And so eventually I'm like, this is me. This is what I'm going to write about.
Yeah, and that's authentic.
Yeah, and there's definitely some nights where maybe emotionally it's harder as far as being vulnerable with certain songs. But I try to tell myself, someone needs to hear this. And if I get upset while I'm singing it or something like that, it's not going to come across the way that I want it to. So I just try to be strong. And you almost have to disassociate a little bit.
Absolutely. For those in our audience that haven't heard your songs, I know that they're often described as front porch country charm with the honesty of folk and the catchiness of pop. I thought, from what I've heard, that description is very appropriate. So how do you describe yourself? Is it like that?
That's probably the best description I have, because I think I was influenced by so many things growing up. I mean, I remember listening to Faith Hill and Shania Twain, but when I was younger and I was learning guitar and learning how to sing, as I got into my teens, I didn't want to identify with country music. Mm-hmm. That wasn't cool. And so I was really into people like Sheryl Crow, Hayley Williams from Paramore, No Doubt, things like that that were probably more alternative rock. And, you know, I grew up on Tom Petty and
sure.
Ozzy Osbourne and all this stuff. So I really rejected the country part for such a long time. And then as I got older, I realized, wait, why am I being that way? Is that just teenage angst? Do I really feel that way? And then I started to realize there's a lot of honesty in country. I love Dolly Parton. I love those storytellers. And if you're a songwriter, you're a storyteller. It doesn't always matter what genre you fall into. And so I think I'm just this mixture of all of that.
Well, isn't it great that you as a songwriter can take all of those diverging styles and bring them into something that's yours?
For sure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the song that we're going to play.
Yeah. So Picking Dandelions is kind of, it came from a place of us needing to put our cell phones down and kind of be more in touch with nature. It's also kind of a battle cry. I feel like it's a little anti-government a little bit, but at the heart of it, it's just like, stop watching the news. Go do something that is good for your mind and your body and your spirit, instead of just staring at a screen and worried about all the craziness happening in the world.
I don't want your greed. That money-making machine. Conquering it.
Sammy, I want to ask you, you know, in the competition for Amplify Nashville, you played as a solo artist, but in the songs that we're hearing today, you're with a band. So tell us a little about that.
So the musicians that you hear on that track, they're all my friends from the Cincinnati area. It's homegrown music, 100%. I'm very proud to say that. I'm so happy to call them friends because they made that song what it is ultimately.
It sounds like everybody's having a lot of fun on that song.
Yes. I think that was everyone's favorite song, honestly, on that EP.
Tell us where we can hear more of your music.
So if you go to sammyriggs.com, links to all my socials are there. All of my music that I've released so far, you can find it anywhere you stream music. So Amazon, Spotify, all that good stuff. And I'm hopefully, you know, going to be putting out some new tunes this year. I have one kind of on the docket that I've already recorded. So I'm hoping to put that out in the next couple of months. It's called Wilderness. I imagine what I kind of want to do with this next set of songs is probably something a little stripped down than what you hear on my Spotify right now. I mean, it could just be me and a guitar, and I think that people would love to listen to them just like that.
Sammy, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. Congratulations on your Amplify Nashville Songwriter Challenge win, and thanks for joining us and sharing your music.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We've been speaking with singer-songwriter Sammy Riggs. You can find out more information about her on her website, sammyriggs.com. That's sammyriggs.com. This is Chuck Wills, and you're listening to the Brown County Hour on WFHB.
This is Pam Rader for the Brown County Hour, and I'm here tonight with John Kay, who made it in on such a cold night. Hi, John.
Hi, Pam. Good seeing you again.
And you are the premier folklorist in our state anyway, and we've had you in several times. I'm going to let you say what your titles are.
Okay.
And
I'm John Kay. I'm the director, longtime director of a program called Traditional Arts Indiana. It's a statewide folk arts program. Every state is supposed to have a folk life specialist, a folklorist. And so I operate as the state folklorist, and I work to identify, document, and promote the folk and traditional arts practiced in the state of Indiana.
Yeah, wow. I didn't know every state had to have one.
And I'm also a professor of folklore at Indiana University, where I've been since 2004.
Okay, thanks. Now, when we bumped into each other, you said there was a Smithsonian exhibit that you were involved in. I thought, there's a story there. So,
well, for the past 22 years or so, I've done a lot of work up at the Indiana State Fair. I used to coordinate the fiddle contest that they had there. I've done a lot of work with the State Fair Masters program that I ran for a while. And I became real good friends with the bowl hewers, these guys that chop out wooden bowls at the Indiana State Fair. And a friend of mine found out I did all this work, and she says, you know, the Smithsonian's going to be doing an exhibit on state fairs in the United States as part of their work with craft. So the Smithsonian Craft Museum is the Renwick Gallery, just down the street from the White House. And they said, I'm going to drop your name with Mary Savage, the curator there, and see if there's any way to get an artist involved or something from Indiana. And I get a call a few weeks later, Mary's going to be coming to the Indiana State Fair, and we do this walking tour through the whole fairgrounds, and I take her to the Pioneer Village. And I said, when we talk about craft, and I said, a lot of my works is with lifelong learning and creative aging. The Pioneer Village is a place where these people come together, often in retirement years, and chop out wooden bowls and quilt quilts and fix up old tractors and show how they used to work the fields and process, do threshing and all of cut timber and all that sort of stuff. So we took her through there and showed her the wheelwright shop and the blacksmith shop, and I introduced her around to various folks. But we ended up centering back on a lot of the work with the bowl hewers that have been going on in Indiana, a really distinctive tradition. It's this chopping out of wooden bowls with green wood, fresh cut wood, into these wooden bowls. It's been done at the Indiana State Fair since the 1970s, since the founding of the Pioneer Village. And so they became really interested in that. They go back to Washington. They call me up and they say, would you consider being like a consulting curator? And could you help us identify some pieces and get those to Washington, D.C.? And so I arranged for a couple of bowls, and I work with Vicki Graber, a basket maker that I work with, and different folks. There were some chairs that were taken up in as well that the Smithsonian ordered. So those ended up going to the Smithsonian. Then they contact me about bringing in Keith Rubel, who's one of the bowl hewers, and they bring him there. And so Keith and I and my wife and his wife get in our car, and we drive to Washington, D.C., and we get to be part of the whole gala opening of this showing of him chopping bowls right there in Washington, D.C. He'd never been to D.C. before in his life. He wasn't going to go unless somebody took him, and so that was my job, to take him there.
That's a great story. I love it. A Hoosier. That goes big time.
Well, Keith Rubel, he was the one that went big time. Was a star of the show. And they had the exhibit, is just amazing if anyone gets to see it. There's this pyramid of jams and jellies. There's a full-size cow carved out of butter. There's all of these quilts and wood carvings and pottery. It's historic state fairs as well as contemporary artists that were there. It's really beautiful. And the craft, the Renwick, the craft gallery, is one of the lesser known museums. It's not like one of the big ones you go into often, but it's really one of the best kept secrets in DC, and really worth people's time.
How long's the exhibit going to be?
It's up through into September of this year. Mm-hmm. So it'll be up all through the summer. Also, as part of that, I wrote a chapter for the catalog for the book that came out with Smithsonian Press, and it's all about the Pioneer Village at the Indiana State Fair, and tells the story of the development of the fair and all the people who kind of came through that, and what that work does, especially in the lives of older adults, of like bringing people together, forming a sense of community, giving people a sense of purpose. And so I just learned a week or two ago that the book is now in its second printing already. It just came out in September of this year, and it's already sold through the first run of it. So that's really good.
You want to give the name of the book?
The name of the book is the same as the exhibit. Is State Fairs Growing American Craft.
And do you have a website or an email or something?
Sure. You can check out everything I do. All my books and everything are available via traditionalarts.indiana.edu. It's a branch of state of Indiana University.
Okay, thanks. I think we could talk for hours, but
I always have plenty to say. I am a folklorist after all.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Now we pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from R. Brown County, a magazine for locals and visitors featuring art, entertainment, and county characters since 1995. Printed six times a year and available online. More information at rbrowncounty.com.
In segment two, Jim Eagleman has a few reflections on burning firewood, and we'll close this segment with a Sammy Riggs song, but first, a Valentine story from our friend Deb Bowden.
A Valentine's card. I was at the Family Dollar the other day to buy a few items when I looped through the stationery aisle. The Valentine's cards caught my eye. I considered getting one for my daughter to celebrate how proud I am of her. Erin accepted a job at the Beef and Board in Indianapolis last year. After working over a decade in other fields, she's finally in theater, the career she chose in college, and is extremely happy. And I'm equally thrilled for her. She does multiple things there, runs the lights high up on the catwalk, designs and constructs sets and moves them around on stage, designs and makes costumes, styles wigs, applies makeup, and creates prosthesis for the actors. Since she's also a singer, songwriter, and actress, she could, in a pinch, fill in on stage. So far, she hasn't wanted to, but the option is there. She said she's grateful for all of her past jobs, which included being assistant manager at other stores, both in Georgia and Indiana. She's been a cake decorator, a dishwasher, and a salesperson also. But since she's very talented and an artistic person, I know how soul-sucking those jobs were for her, even if they did flesh out a long resume. I wasn't exactly sure what type of a card would be appropriate. She told me several years past that Valentine's cards were not acceptable unless they came from a significant other, such as a boyfriend, girlfriend, or husband or wife. She didn't feel one coming from anyone else was proper. So I just browsed, hoping something would jump out at me. I looked in the humors collection. I thought I might find a comical way to say my admiration of her would stretch to the moon and back. No, some of those cards were downright insulting. Other cards were too juvenile, as she's almost 36. Some seemed too strained and impersonal, as they were aimed at friends or co-workers. I found more choices hidden behind or between other stacks. Some had poems or sayings inside which held promise, but I didn't like the pictures on the outside. Old-fashioned, nostalgic, or out-of-date fronts wouldn't do. Neither my daughter nor I are Victorian tea-cozy types, as she and I sport tattoos, she has piercings, gauges, and is goth, while I write horror novels and children's books with black cats and skeletons. Those cards fit about as well as a size 42 bib overall would fit a local raccoon. Not. I'm always beginning to think that there wasn't a perfect choice in that store. I left disappointed. Back home, I dug out some cards that had no sayings at all inside. They were meant for the sender to scribble their own message. I found one that I thought would do. It features a mother giraffe and her calf. I sat down, card opened, and considered what might be an acceptable way to express my pride and love. Everything I jotted on scrap paper just didn't seem to fit the bill and not possibly offend her. Finally, I decided to pen a short, simple message. I wrote, "I'm so proud of you. Love, Mom." I'm mailing it soon, and my fingers are crossed for luck. I hope the perfect way to send your thoughts can be found for everyone this Valentine's Day, just as I pray I did. Blessed be, and love to all this February.
To an admitted wood lover, one who heats with wood, works it into piles of logs and suitable lengths for the wood stove, then lets it season for at least a year, the wood stacks piled outside in between trees, or standing alone, all on planks to keep it off the ground, this being a sign of either peculiar neatness or just a weird stacking obsession of mine, the fall of the year brings on yet another challenging and rewarding time to eventually sit back and toast the Tootsies near the warmth of a wood stove as it pumps out the required BTUs, thus satisfying the mission of this possessed wood stove owner. That's me. And thanks to the volumes of social media postings from others who suffer this malady, there is never a loss of more information about heating with wood, splitting and stacking wood, the proper method to cut and produce kindling, how to install a stovepipe, how to clean the wood stove, and what to do with the ashes. I'm always looking to learn how others do this ritual of heating with wood. You can learn a lot by watching the habits and sometimes the failures of those who heat with wood. To date, there are only about 1.5% of the entire Indiana population that heat with wood, or 40,000 some 260 homes. Arbor Analytics, the source that provides these figures, it does not differentiate if you heat with wood entirely or, like me, have a wood stove as supplementary. We have the electric hot air handler, the heat pump, for the most majority of our heating needs, but as I hear from many people, those who heat with wood, like me, quote, there's just something about a wood stove or fireplace that makes home living that much more comfortable, end quote. When we built in the mid-80s, I had visions of a rustic Brown County sandstone fireplace in our living room, so large that it would be the absolute center of attention when you entered, a rustic mantle made of seasoned and gnarled oak at the proper height, tall enough if I wished I could rest my elbow in it, maybe with my pipe that I smoked at the time. And as I surveyed my little kingdom, our young sons would play at my feet, my slippers nearby, the dog looking up occasionally, all of us very content. What a serene vision, and one I recall in the home I grew up in, my dad, the keeper of the flames. Every now and then he'd let me strike the match that would set the newspaper and kindling a blaze. I'd look mesmerized into the flames, proud of what I had just done. And now the chance to have this iconic and massive fireplace in my own home, I was ecstatic. But no, it was not to be. No sooner had I suggested to the stonemason at the time my plans for the fireplace that the workers, the carpenter and his helper, and even a close friend who had a fireplace, they voiced their disapproval at the idea. Too much heat up the chimney, I heard. And a wasteful and expensive commodity used only a few times a year, another comment. You'll want to conserve the heat you make, and a wood stove is the best choice. I was quickly talked out of the idea, adding I didn't care how wasteful and silly it was. I wanted a fireplace in my home. The wood stove chimney was soon constructed and took the place of my fantasized fireplace. I was defeated. My preferred choice of Indiana hardwoods to use is only limited by where the dead tree happens to occur. And I said dead tree, as there appears to always be an unlimited supply of dead ash around from the emerald ash borer, this disease a few years ago. Dead ash on steep slopes are left for the woodpeckers that come. They will have plenty of wood-boring beetles and grubs. These trees slowly die. EAB ash trees show sloughed-off pieces of bark that are a sure sign with many dead branches. And the power company along our road took down several of these trees as a threat to power lines. I sawed and split the limbs in the main trunk over several weeks, sacked the wood in an area of sun, and now 2 years later I'm using this wood. Other dead oaks, hickory, cherry, and maple add to my varied selection, although I find it difficult to keep it separate, so I don't always know what I'm burning. Whatever it is, it works. Some friends are better at keeping the wood they burn separate and say it's the large, seasoned chunks of oak they use only on the coldest nights. They call these large, awkward chunks all-nighters. I offer my wood to my closest friends who still heat with wood but no longer cut. I say to come and haul it off themselves, or occasionally I can deliver to others, depending on the quantity. If they are desperate, I make it available at the market costs. I have a lot of wood, and that is dry and ready to burn, and I feel happy to make it available to those who really need it. A small handheld meter allows me to determine the amount of moisture a piece of wood contains. Two probes stuck into the end of a log show the percentage of moisture. Testing with this instrument many times, I have never had the reading less than 13% moisture, the average about 12 to 15. That's after nearly 2 years of drying. As the different hardwoods with cracks and splits, it's a sure sign the amount of air is doing its job. My woodshed has been full for only 3 years, and I've begun stacking the wood outside on planks. Happiness is a full woodshed, says a friend. Upon seeing my full shed and other stacked wood nearby, he jokes there must be a retired forester who lives there. Do you heat with wood? I'd love to hear your story. Contact me here at the Brown County Hour at studio@browncountyhour.com. Thanks. Talk to you next time.
The Brown County Library is offering the Benefits of Laughter for all ages and all peoples. Tuesday, February the 17th at 2 p.m., Sarah Lytle presents The Universal Language of Laughter. We teach children manners, social cues, but babies come out of the womb knowing how to laugh. Watching their fingers move, playing with their fingers, their toes, and laughing freely. As adults, we're taught to straighten up, get serious, act right, when often our hearts want to just lighten up. We will revisit ways to unlock the barriers to levity and find strength in the power of laughter. A happy heart is a healthy heart. Discover more on February 17th, 2 p.m., at the Brown County Library for the Universal Language of Laughter.
So this song is Backwoods Bound, and I wrote this song just about having some fun in the Kentucky hills. Hope you like it.
Signals we gotta get away from the thick of it all. Load it on up and make the haul. We've been living so fast. Let's slow it down. If the money's too tight to leave this town, we gotta figure it out. We're back.
We pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on Volunteer Powered Community Radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org.
Support for WFHB comes from the Brown County Inn, located just off the main street of Nashville, Indiana, at 51 State Road 46 East. Brown County Inn is also a restaurant, bar, and gathering place for visitors and locals alike. More information at browncountyinn.com. In our final segment, we'll talk about Stonehead, a mile marker sculpture in Brown County in the shape of a head, carved by Henry Cross in 1851. In November 2016, vandals stole the head in a case that remains cold. Stonehead Nature Preserve owner Mike Kelly talks with Sarah Lytle about the history of this unique monument and wonders if the mystery will ever be solved. Dave Seastrom shares the origin story of meeting his wife Becky, and we'll close the show with the Sammy Riggs song, Run Ruby. But first, we begin segment three with a truly Brown County story of neighbors helping neighbors. The author of the photo book, Brown County Folks, Rick Albertson, couldn't resist testing the four-wheel drive capability of his big pickup truck during that massive snowstorm we had in December. Spoiler alert, it did not go as planned.
That's right, Chad. As you know, I live in an 1880s log cabin that sits up upon a hilltop. My gravel driveway is very steep and over 300 feet long. Even when dry, very few vehicles can make it to the top of the drive without four-wheel drive. My pickup truck certainly cannot. I'm usually only at the cabin in the spring and the fall, so I've never had to deal with snow and ice. I've often wondered if I could make it up the drive in the winter, and I had a chance to find out if I could make it to the top after we received about 4 inches of snow. Immediately turning off the road onto my property, the driveway crosses a large culvert over the creek, about 8 feet high above the creek. Unfortunately, as I was to find, the gravel on the bottom of the driveway is sloped somewhat towards the drop-off to the creek. I had parked my truck overnight on the top of the drive near the cabin the night before the snowfall. The next day, I just couldn't resist trying to find out if I could make it up the drive. I very slowly crept down the drive in four-wheel drive with no problems. Once down, I turned my truck around and proceeded to make the climb. I was very surprised that I could make absolutely no progress up the drive, all four wheels spinning on the snow. I gave the truck a little gas to get some grip. That was a mistake. The back tires of the truck suddenly slid sideways down the slightly soaked gravel towards the drop-off to the creek. By the time I stopped, the truck's rear passenger side tire was just barely still on the driveway. I was convinced it might continue to slide and soon end up in the creek. I quickly exited the truck and placed a large rock under the other rear tire, hoping it would hold the truck from further slipping. Well, it was obvious that the truck wasn't going to be able to climb the long, steep drive. I remembered that I had a heavy 20-foot-long chain in the back of the truck. I retrieved it and was attempting to secure the front of the truck to a nearby tree when suddenly a fellow stopped on the road and asked if he could help. He was driving a very aggressive off-wheel vehicle and said he liked to help people in situations like I found myself in. He arrived less than a minute after all of this happened and with the absolutely perfect vehicle with which to rescue me. Think whatever you will, but I'm convinced this was a clear instance of divine intervention and that Philip was my guardian angel. In short order, he was able to winch the back of my truck away from the drop-off so that I could back down in order for him to pull in front of me. Philip then attached a tow strap between the front of my truck and the rear of his off-road beast. The tires are massive. I got back in my truck and was amazed that he was able to seemingly effortlessly pull me 300 feet to the top of the drive. Less than 10 minutes later, he was off and gone. That guardian angel thing. 2 years ago, when I was conducting interviews for the Brown County Folks book, several of the people I spoke to related similar stories in which a member of the community had come to their aid, willing to, as the saying goes, give them the shirt off their back. No shirt in my case, but a mighty needed rescue. I'm so thankful to be part of a community where folks are so willing to help one another. I hope Philip hears the story and knows just how thankful I am for his help.
I'm Sarah Lytle at the Brown County Hour, and I'm here to talk about an unsolved mystery of Brown County at 135 South, where it tees into Bellsville Pike, Stonehead Nature Preserve. And I brought in Mike Kelly, a 25-year Brown County resident, property manager, and owner of the Stonehead Nature Preserve.
Correct.
Hello, Mike.
Hi, Sarah. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with your audience today.
And I would like you to tell me what happened 10 years ago when you got a phone call and you were in Florida.
Well, we had actually spent our last night from our Florida vacation in Gatlinburg, and no sooner gotten up and finished our first cup of coffee and hit the road, and I got a call from a local resident who all she said was, "What happened to the Stonehead?" And of course, right then, I knew, because I'd had these thoughts in the past that something might happen to it someday. And I knew it wasn't going to be good. So whatever it was, so I said, "Well, what happened?" And she said, "Well, the head is missing," which I figured that's what it was, because, the base of the Stonehead has been secured with cement, because mm-hmm. it was actually stolen once before, back in the early 1970s. But unlike the first time it was stolen, this time it was actually, vandalized and damaged. The head was broken off. So it was a long drive home, needless to say. And I had trouble concentrating on the road, but I wasn't home 45 minutes before I called the local sheriff, and they came out and took pictures and things like that. And that's what happened.
So the decapitation still exists. The head has never been found.
It's never been found. It wasn't like the head was shattered. It was missing. Now, there were a few shards around the base of it, which I collected and saved, but that just looked like pieces of the neck. So it obviously got broken off at the weakest point.
Yeah. You told me this was a waystone, and that you consider this one the gateway to southern Indiana. Tell me, what is a waystone, and are there others?
Well, waystones go all the way back to Roman Empire days. They had quite an intricate road system. And so back then, they didn't have metal signs, so they used the local material, which were stones and probably wood too, but the wooden signs wouldn't last.
And they were used for markers.
Yes, they were markers, a way of disseminating information about which way to go.
Yeah, who carved this one?
This one was carved by a local tombstone carver who is quite well known. He has a number of intricate design tombstones throughout the area, not just Brown County, but surrounding counties. And he was asked to do this in lieu of taxes.
And his name?
His name was Henry Cross.
Okay. And that was what? I think the date on it was 1851?
1851. Nashville wasn't established until 1836. So I figure by 1851, they were organized enough to be working on the roads and getting new gravel roads established and things like that. But they soon found out that they were hard to maintain. So they had various able-bodied men in the community volunteer their services in lieu of taxes to work on these roads.
Well, in Brown County, we value and restore history and historical things. It is very much a historical and personal piece. We're coming up, you said this happened in November 10 years ago. So it'll be the 10th anniversary of the missing head.
November 4th and 5th.
So what are your thoughts, Mike, on moving forward with this?
Well, I can tell you, it's beginning to feel like a sentimental journey that's no longer being traveled. It's still considered an open case, but I don't think it's ever been considered an active investigation. So like any murder that gets investigated, after a while, if you run out of leads, check those out, everything checks out okay, you don't get any new leads, then what they'll do a lot of times is have a media blitz. Mm-hmm. And that's something we might want to consider, put it out publicly, put it in the public's eye again. And sometimes when you do that, you can stir up new leads. It happened 10 years ago, and at the time, I've always felt that more than one person knows what happened to that head. Well, they may be less reluctant to offer some information. You know, maybe they know that their friend who did it is now long out of the county, and maybe we can get that head back. That would be the best scenario.
So Mike told me he's tired and retired, but he'll hold the space for people who are interested in helping solve the mystery or replace the head. And anybody out there who is hearing this and wants to, if you want to get involved, Mike, they call you or text you?
They can call or text 317-409-2029. Thank you, Sarah, for the opportunity to keep the Stonehead spirit alive. I think everybody's always been intrigued with an unsolved murder mystery, but it's my hope that someday this one can be solved to the community's satisfaction.
Thank you for coming in. This has been Mike Kelly at the Brown County Hour. I'm Sarah Lytle.
A week before Christmas in 1993, a very attractive 35-year-old FedEx courier knocked on my front door. In her hand was a package from my friend Mark that contained a plane ticket to New York for my son Ben. My daughter Lodi answered the door, and when the young lady asked for a signature so she could release the package and be on her way, a smiling Lodi said, "My dad says not to sign for anything." The courier was running late, and she was none too happy with this response. Here she was at the end of a dead-end road at the farthest reaches of her route, late for her family's Christmas party, and this is the response she gets? Lodi pointed to my jewelry shop just as I was coming out of the door to see what was going on and said, "That's my dad. You can talk with him." Smiling, I approached this young lady and asked what she needed. As soon as she told me, I signed Z papers and she walked back to her truck. She climbed in, put it in gear, and my dog, Bugs, ran out in front of her. She stopped her truck, and I informed her that this was his way of having fun and not to worry about it. And in that moment, we began talking. I've always had a thing for ladies in uniform, and as we spoke, I noticed that she was wearing the cutest little steel-toed boots I'd ever seen. A minute into our conversation, she looked at her watch and said she had enough time for a break and followed me into the jewelry shop, my invitation. At that time, I was making a line of wacky bolo ties. When I showed them to her, she said, "Wacky is good," and I thought, we might be on to something. After our brief visit, she needed to go, and I followed her to a truck to see her off. As I was walking backwards and waving goodbye, she said, "You wouldn't happen to be single, would you?" When I affirmed my bachelorhood, she wrote her phone number on a notepad, handed the paper to me, and drove off in a cloud of dust. Holding the paper in my hand, I realized that something special had happened, and I wondered how many times she had dished out this info. To this day, Becky stands by her word that I'm the one and only customer she ever passed this information to. Our first phone call took place during a raging thunderstorm, and we could barely hear each other speak. Somehow, we managed to arrange our first date that took place a few days later at the Irish Lion. The first time I recorded a version of this encounter was exactly 10 years ago. As a way of updating our story, I'll share the tale of how we eventually got married. 7 years later, Becky and I were spending time on our sailboat in Pine Island, Florida. After much discussion, we agreed to go to the county clerk's office in Cape Coral and jump the broom. As a concession, she promised that we could go to a boat salvage yard on the way home. We were waiting in line behind a couple who were both 18. The young man was completely pie-eyed, and he couldn't take his eyes off his attractive potential bride. The clerk had the discretion to require them to take a few classes before she would issue their marriage license because they were both under 21. She signed them up for conflict resolution, responsible finances, and baby care. In a moment of absolute rage, the pretty blonde lady turned to us, pointed her finger, and shouted, "Are you going to make these two take a bunch of classes?" The smiling clerk, completely calm when she said, "They look like a couple of veterans to me." As she grabbed her potential spouse by the ear and began leading him out of the room, I thought about pulling him aside and telling him, "You may not know it yet, young man, but this is the luckiest day of your life." We made our pledge and said our I do's, signed on the dotted line, and we were officially married. The good state of Florida gave us a gift bag that contained a small box of Tide and a package of Pampers. As I recall, we used the Pampers to wipe things up in the boat. When we set the date, Becky suggested Tuesday, and I agreed without having any idea that it was St. Valentine's Day. In this way, she created an ideal romantic matrimonial experience that, thanks to her, I'll never forget the date. In the "you never know what might happen and sometimes life turns on a dime" category, 32 years after we met, we'll be celebrating 26 years of marriage this February 14th. This is Dave Seastrom. See you next time.
This song is called "Run Ruby Run," and this is a true story about my grandmother Ruby from Russell Springs, Kentucky.
Boy alone.
thanks for tuning in to episode 167 of the Brown County Hour. This show was recorded in our studio at the History Center here in downtown Nashville and brought to you the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. and the following Wednesday at 6 p.m. and anytime online. Be sure to look for us on your favorite streaming services.
The Brown County Hour is brought to you by a diverse group of folks who believe, now more than ever, the world is for everyone.
This show was produced by
Chuck Wills,
Pam Rader,
Rick Fettig,
Vera Grubbs,
Lucy Schultz,
Sarah Lytle,
Chad Carruthers,
and Dave Seastrom. We would also like to thank Slats Klug for our theme music. You have been listening to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County. Home.